All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on the 7th day of July, 2020. Before I talk more about today's show, I do like to remind you I'm the editor of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can sign up for that newsletter by going to miningstocks.com. miningstocks.com, and I would suggest that now is the best time that I've seen in a long time to consider subscribing to my letter, because these junior mining companies that I'm following are really moving very aggressively and making people that own them a lot of money. So it is a good time. 718-457-1426. You can go there, give us a call during normal working hours, or just simply go to miningstocks.com and sign up for the letter there. Also encourage you to consider signing up for Chen Lin's letter. Chen does well in the mining space as well, but his real winners have come more recently, at least in the biotech sector. So if you're interested in someone who covers the exciting high-risk, high-reward biotech sector, Chen Lin is your place to go to for that. I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel, and I also want to encourage you to continue sending along your questions or comments, whatever they may be, to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions is number 4@gmail.com. Also want to thank our sponsors, because without them there would be no show. Our sponsors this week: Great Bear Resources, Benchmark Metals, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, and Sitka Gold Corp. Normally, Michael Oliver would be with us today every other week, but due to a scheduling conflict, he is unable to be with me and to join me today. He is scheduled to be back next week, however. But in his absence, I thought I would pass along a couple of his comments from this past weekend's 360-degree weekend report Michael puts out every Saturday or Sunday, and it's that in itself is well worth the subscription. He has missives that come out during the week, too. He covers lots and lots of markets, besides the ones he normally talks to us about when he's on the show. But I'll just pass along a couple of remarks that he made in his 360 weekend report concerning gold and silver and a couple of the things that we track, mostly in the equity markets. Regarding the equity markets, Michael wrote, and I quote, "The action since June 11th, that is the sharp drop day, has been repeatedly groping to get back up to 3,200 to rejoin that 4 days of action up there in early June. But so far, with repeated rallies, even Thursdays, the market has failed to achieve that and failed to erase that possible island top. The clock is ticking. Get it done, bulls, or watch this process roll over." End of quote. Well, as we were going to start this show today, it was the S&P 500 was selling at 3160. I see it's right now at 3159. So it is a little ways below that key level that Michael thinks, but he thinks they better get it done quickly or it's going to roll over. So Michael has been bearish on the equity market. I think it surprised him. It's resilience and its ability to stay up there. But, hey, they keep throwing trillions of dollars into the system, and if it can't get out into the real economy, it stays in the financial markets. Well, I would say that's the reason stocks are going on, and there is indeed, unfortunately, a major, major disconnect between the equity markets and what's happening in the real economy. No matter what Donald Trump might tell you or anybody that's in office, all the presidents always put out reports that are suspect, I think. So either party, that's been my experience in the past. Anyway, other things that Michael had to say. He commented on Microsoft, commented and gave charts, always gives charts, various commodities, including soybeans, sugar, base metals. With regard to silver, let me just quote what he said about that. He said, silver has a pending level overhead on its annual momentum that we've specified before. Trade to 20% over the zero line, 36-month average, and this annual momentum chart will blow its cork with a triple top breakout. Two prior peaks in 2016 and 2019 halted precisely at 19.4% over the 36-month average. The 20% breakout number applicable for July is a trade up to $19.48. That's a 78-cent troy ounce above last week's traded high in July silver. So he's looking at the July contract. I keep my eyes on the spot contract, but the forward is usually is considerably higher. So anyway, Michael says, see that, and if you see that level, 1948, expect silver to begin an advance that takes it to the undesirable, or the underside, I should say, not undesirable if you're a bull, it's very desirable, to the underside of $30 before any serious pause. So in other words, get over 1948, and Michael thinks that we're going to see a straight line pretty much up towards $30 for silver. And as we were going to the show, silver was trading on the spot market at 1827 bid, 1838 ask. Regarding senior gold mining stocks as compared to the more junior stocks, those that are closer to the kind of companies that I cover in my newsletter, J. Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, Michael showed a couple of charts displaying the juniors as measured by GDXJ is catching up with their more senior brethren, GDX. Now, you need to see the charts in Michael's letter to really appreciate this, but the GDXJ has broken through the underside of a downtrend channel and is looking very strong at this point relative to GDX. You know, you need to go to olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com, and sign up for Michael's letter to really get the full advantage. Michael comes on. He shares his time with us. He'll be with us next week. But Michael Oliver is really worth listening to, really worth reading more than listening to. And his charts are really, really helpful in understanding. And he's been so helpful to me, which is why I have him on so constantly on this show. I would just add that the really big miners in a bull market like the one we're in now, the really big gold miners are the first to move. Then the smaller companies begin to move as the large fish start to devour or seek after and swim and consume the smaller ones. Assuming the bull market in gold will continue as I do through 2021, I really believe that we're going to see an increasing number of mergers and acquisitions as the big companies are really depleting their reserves and can't really find them fast enough to replace what they're producing. And this will inevitably lead to bidding, I think, among the big boys for the smaller producers that can help sustain the lives of the big mining companies. It will also lead to the acquisition of major new gold deposits, several of which are emerging with the exploration companies that I follow at J. Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, which you can subscribe to, again, by going to miningstocks.com. Now, one company that figures to be hunted down by the majors is Great Bear Resources, which put out yet another fantastic assay on Monday. I believe this is a 10 million plus ounce gold deposit in the making in Ontario at the Red Lake, in the Red Lake District of Ontario. And I think it figures to be one of the major prizes that I believe the big guys are going to be looking after. Chris Taylor, the president of Great Bear, will be with me next week to give us an update. But I can tell you personally that I am hanging on to the remaining shares that I own in Great Bear for dear life. This report that was put out this past weekend showed continuing high grades at depth, and in fact, the width of the zones and the high grades are expanding at depth. It's continuous. The drill results are showing amazing continuity, which is always important. You don't want blank spots in between gold deposits, but if you have continuous gold mineralization, that really adds to the economics. The size of this thing just keeps getting bigger. The depth keep hitting deeper holes that are still mineralized. It is an amazing story and one that I think hasn't seen its peak by any means at this point in time. in terms of the deposit. Of course, as they start to delineate the resource, I think more and more people will have a firm grasp of just how valuable that company's Dixie project is. In addition to Great Bear, there are several other stocks that I follow in my letter that I think have the potential to become major winners. Companies like Novo Resources, Irving Resources, Klondike Gold, Lion One, Galway Metals, Sitka Gold Corp. There are others as well. There are many others, and it's just a really an amazing, exciting time to be in this industry because these companies are able to raise money, test their geological theories, put holes in the ground to test those theories, and when they're finding major deposits, as several of them are, it's a very exciting time to be owning these stocks. So I hope that you will consider, once again, to sign up for my letter. You know, one of the non-gold stocks that I'm extremely bullish about is Hannon Metals, which has discovered a deposit that I believe will be a massive copper-silver deposit in Peru. In just a few minutes, Michael Hudson of Hannon Metals will be with me to give you an update on that company's San Martin project. Now, this was Bob Moriarty's top pick for this year, and since then it has risen from around 17 cents in Canadian money to 38 cents, even before any drilling has taken place. But this is an amazing story as well, and one I think has huge upside potential. And it is so large, the deposit, it needs to be drilled and delineated. But based on surface expressions, and they do know a lot about the third dimension of this geology because the oil companies were in there doing a lot of exploration earlier before Hannon got involved in this. So there's a lot of geological information. They know a lot about the depth of these deposits and structures, and the surface grades are very high, silver and copper. So a very exciting story. And you'll hear from Michael Hudson right after, in just a couple of minutes as soon as we finish our first commercial break. Well, I've titled today's show Dollar Destruction and a Golden Chinese Currency. My main guest today is Alistair MacLeod. Alistair argues that a dollar collapse is likely to occur by the end of 2020, taking all the synchronized Western economies and their currencies down with it. With a dollar collapse, China's interest will shift, Alistair argues, from supporting dollar strength to owning the world's reserve currency. But Alistair believes that will require China to back the renminbi, or the yuan, with gold, and he says China can easily do that given the vast supplies of gold it has accumulated over the past several decades. With a dollar with the dollar's demise, Alistair believes not only gold but other tangible assets, starting with other monetary metals like silver and copper, will thrive as well. Well, we do have to go to commercial break now, but don't go away because as soon as we come back, Michael Hudson will be with us to talk about the San Martin project, which I think is well worth listening to. It's one that I have invested in. It is a top pick in my newsletter, so I hope you'll hang around to hear what Michael has to say. And then finally, the second half of today's show, I'll be talking to Alistair MacLeod about a very important issue as well. So don't go away. I'll be right back with Michael Hudson.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Michael Hudson. Michael is the CEO and chairman of Hannon Metals Corp. He also serves on the board of directors of that company. Michael is a geologist with a rich career as an exploration geologist. I think of him as an economic geologist. I don't know if he considers himself that, but I think every geologist that's involved in finding deposits has to start thinking about the economic potential of those deposits. And I know Michael gives a great deal of thought to that, so hopefully we'll talk to him a little bit about that. He's, as I say, a rich history. He's been in Pakistan, Australia, and Peru. We spent a lot of time in Peru, and that's where Hannon Metals is involved in exploration and developing what has the potential, I believe, to become a world-class sedimentary-hosted copper and silver deposit. The Hannon story is a very exciting one, and one in which I think investors have a chance to make a lot of money. It's certainly one that I'm really excited about. I purchased it myself. It is a recommendation in my newsletter, so I'm really pleased to say hello to Michael. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Good morning from Australia.
And good evening from New York City here on Friday, and your Saturday morning there. I should just mention quickly to my listeners, Hannon trades in Toronto under the symbol HAN. You can buy it down here in the States, as I have, under HANNF. 74.7 million shares outstanding at 39 cents in Canadian money gives it a market cap of around $29 million in Canadian funds. So it's still a baby of a company, but it's a baby of a company with quite a large target that it's looking at and very nice grades. So, Michael, I'm wondering if you could, maybe as much as possible in lay terms, give our listeners a sense of the scale and grade of what you're seeing with your copper and silver sedimentary hosted deposit there. It's known as the San Martin Project in Peru. And then perhaps tell us, talk about some reasons for optimism with this project.
Thanks, Jay. We have this project that you've outlined very well in northeastern Peru. It's over the Andes and into the high jungle, relatively new part of the world to explore. That's seen a lot of oil exploration from the 80s, but literally the mineral explorers of the world haven't really done much work there. And so we're the first mover. We've got a staking rush around us now in terms of other peers coming in, but we've been slowly acquiring ground in this area since 2018, and then permits were started to be granted at the end of 2019, and then we literally got in there at the end of 2019, and had four teams working, and the opportunity has become very evident only over the last 6 months, really, how this project's been pulled together. So in lay terms, we have a sediment-hosted system, which means that just much, very much like the layers of a cake, our copper forms at those layers, and it's forming at layers that are incredibly vast. We've got tenure over 120 kilometres, and we've got some very good past geological information from the oil explorers that allows us to say that one piece of the cake joins to other pieces of the cake layer over that 120 kilometres. Mm-hmm. And the grade is good. We're seeing grades that are very similar to analogues at a much earlier stage. So the key analogue here is what is called the Kupferschiefer, which is the world's single largest silver producer, even though it's a copper mine, and it's the sixth largest copper producer on Earth. Also, it's in Poland, and we're seeing grades and thicknesses of similar scale. But of course, this is exploration; it's early days, and there's inherent risk in taking points in space and drawing lines between them without doing the work. And so, we're trying to infill those lines.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when do you think you might start? You're looking at surface mineralization, aren't you? You're getting right on surface. You're doing these samples, grab samples, or I don't know, channel samples, or grab samples, or what kind of samples are you getting?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jay. So we're literally the prospectors of the past with our boots and our geological hammers, and we're walking up creeks and finding little thumbnail green chips, and these chips become bigger and bigger until you get boulders, the size of sort of the bonnet of your car, and then they stop. So that's where they're shedding down from the hills above us, and we walk up the hills or find the roads. And that's the impressive thing, is that we're now becoming predictive in which areas to go and find where the rock comes to surface. And then we can ship it, and that's where we're getting those thicknesses and grades over tens and tens of kilometres. So it's early stage, no drilling yet. In fact, it needs a lot more geological work to nail down just the better parts of the system. And we've got a team of four geologists and support staff ready to fly them back to Peru.
So did you say you have people on the ground there now that can do that, or you're going to have to send some people in to do that, that kind of work?
Well, it wasn't that obvious. We've got a local team in Lima. One senior person who comes in and out of the country, Lars Dalenbori, who's been the brains really behind pulling this together on the ground. But everybody, you never succeed. I've had a history of working around the world, and you never succeed with bringing in foreigners. You need to use local people. And we've got local people working for us on the ground from a social licensing perspective today, and they're moving around the community, and we're supporting the community and helping the community during this terrible disease that is spreading around the world. But the other team members come from other parts of Peru.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you, Michael, this structure is relatively flat lying then, I guess, right? You're talking about beds that are flat lying, or what's the orientation? You say you have a lot of information because of the oil drillers in the past, so you have some. You know a lot about structure, I guess, is what I'm getting at, right? And the orientation of these beds.
Yeah, there's a few key points around that question, Jay, and it's a good one. We do know at the gross scale where this layer exists over the 120 kilometres. We can be predictive where it hits the surface, and we can be predictive of how it goes beneath the surface. We build a 3D model from that vast data that's 300 kilometres long and 180 kilometres wide. So that's an unusual perspective to be able to do that in any basin in the world for a mineral explorer. The other key point is that the orientation matters for potential mining. If these are quite thin, at least at some of the areas that we found, we have found thicker zones as well. But if it's going to be thin, you want it to be relatively flat lying, because then the mineability of it and the continuity of it, where you can actually mine it at a cost that makes sense, is much more amenable, I suppose, is a key point. So you don't want it to be too steep, and we've got gently folding, a bit like waves, right? They go up and down, but it's not like a vertical wall.
Well, that's positive. Then, of course, we'll be learning much more as you start drilling and we get the third dimension in this deposit. The last time you were on, I think it was March 17th, so we're almost 3 months ago. It is more than 3 months ago, or something like that. Anyway, I want to ask you, you've had a lot of information. I mean, just this month, you put out several news releases, and the stock has performed very well, even though copper hasn't really been, well, I guess it's up a little bit. Silver's up a little bit. Gold's been really the hot metal. But your shares are really performing quite well, I'd say, in spite of, but you've had a lot of information. Maybe you could cover some of the things that have taken place since we last spoke on March 17th. For example, back on May 28th, you say you increased your granted mining concession by 50% in Peru. So is that 110 kilometer strike that you're talking about, I guess that includes that 50% increase in land size, right?
Yeah, so what we had was that we had applications that moved to be granted, which allows us to work on them. So the Peruvian administration was very busy, and it's very important, right? Because an application is just a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. A granted concession allows you certain rights to potentially to explore it, definitely, and potentially mine it. We're not talking about mining now; we're just exploring. But it gives you that license. So that was that. That's very, a key part of the story, of course.
Yeah.
And since then, the results that have flowed since last time we spoke, and how quickly time does go, is from all the work we did, the work programs during December through to March, and And the key, really, the key aspect is that we're demonstrating the continuity of this project at various scales. So we're working literally over 100 kilometres, and then we started to narrow it down to sort of a 20-kilometre trend where we're finding these grades in outcrop that we just talked about. And then most importantly, we're starting to narrow it down over a few kilometres of scale, and we found a new area that's a couple of kilometres south of one area that we knew about, and then we were able to find multiple points within a 500-metre trend. And this is important because it's just demonstrating and building confidence at the different scales, and ultimately that will come by drilling, but this is the kind of thing we want to see, and there's a lot more work to be done and a lot more ground to walk on. And literally, you know, I was in the field with teams just at the end of February, early March also, and it was very exciting, you know, daily that the teams were bringing back new discoveries of copper and silver, and there's nothing more thrilling than that for an exploration geologist.
Absolutely. Well, I guess you're able to do an awful lot of work in preparation for that drilling then, before you start to do the really expensive work and start putting drill holes down. You are pretty well funded though, I believe, aren't you, Michael, for what you're doing now anyway?
Yes, we raised $2.2 million at the end of December, January. And we had a $1.5 million budget, which we're only a little bit into, really, and that included some drilling that we hoped it was going to be at the end of this year. Of course, that's going to be pushed into next year now with the delays we've seen from the COVID lockdown. But we've got $1.5 million in the bank still, no urgency to seek any funding necessarily. Although there's a hell of a lot of interest in this project, Jay.
Oh yes, there is indeed, and I think given the scale and the grades and all of that, I can't imagine that there aren't some big mining companies that at least know about what you're about or know something about what's going on there. Just with a couple of minutes left, then, Michael, you know, you've had a lot of experience. You've worked. You've been in this industry for quite a few years. Give us an idea of what really has to come together to make something work, to make something really, really good. What are some of the ingredients? I mean, we know that it's always good to look at people who have been successful. It's one of the reasons that you're in my newsletter and why I like to look at your company. Projects always matter. Can you fund those kind of things? But just in general, what should investors, because there's a lot of new people starting to pay attention to this space now, what should they really be watching for? What does it take from the early stages as your project is to make it work? What should people be watching for?
Yeah, it's really a question around management of exploration, which is really only similar to if you're going to find another industry that is a comparable is R&D in the pharmaceutical business. Mm-hmm. So we have scientists who are second. Well, who collect data, make theories, and then collect more data and alter their theories based on that new data. It's often unsuccessful. Exploration is not a very forgiving business, and it's not many geologists that make those discoveries. And literally, we've got a filter. And so it's risk management internally, and that's risk at so many different levels, geological risk, political risk, geological, the details of every little piece of data that we take in the field every day, whether we should go back and explore there or explore anywhere else. But simply put, you want to back your technical team if you have the right people. You want to give them consistency of funding, but you don't want geologists who are starting to prove something is not there. So you want them to move on, because it's a cost benefit business, and like any business is, and you don't want to spend dollars when they'd be better spent elsewhere. So really what we do, and the simple line is back the right people, and those right people are the managers of risk, and then you've got to have a sniff or a sense, and it's tenacity of only a few people that I know who make those discoveries. And they're generally the people that are hard to manage. They're the people that go out on a limb and, uh-huh. and you know, that go the extra mile, or like extra 50 meters up the hill to get that outcrop.
Uh-huh. So they've people that have a mind of their own as independent thinkers, I guess, also. So if I hear what you're saying is fatal flaws, if you can find the fatal flaw early on, then move on to another project. That's one of the keys, right?
That's one of the key points, absolutely, because geologists tend to fall in love with a project that's said, and so you want geologists who are commercial, who know all the aspects of whether something can work, and that's just not rocks in the ground, but that's social risk, political risk, that's metallurgical risk, that's mining risk that we've touched on in our talk today. So there's so many aspects, and another show in the making there for you, Jay. I think if we're going to talk about one through.
We sure could do that, and I find it very interesting that you compare it to the pharmaceutical industry, because my good friend Chen Lin, who does very well both in the exploration industry and in the pharmaceutical industry, says the same thing. It really it's very much very similar in many ways. So I guess that's about all the time we have today. Any last word, maybe what people should be watching for, any news that might be on the horizon?
Well, we're keeping working behind the scenes here, Jay, with so many things. Both technically, we can work with the data, and we're talking with lots of potential partners as well. So we're still very busy in Hannon, and the news flow will continue.
Wonderful. Looking forward to it. It's an exciting story for sure. So thank you very much, Michael, for being with us, and we'll look to keep up with you in the future.
Always a pleasure, Jay. Thank you for having me on again.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their 23-kilometer flagship Dixie project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Ontario. Having recently made multiple high-grade gold discoveries, GBR is fully funded to complete a very active 200,000-meter drill program through to the year 2021. Stay up to date on what's been considered one of the best performing exploration stocks in the last 2 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me one of our most frequent guests, Alistair MacLeod. And Alistair writes these weekly essays at goldmoney.com, goldmoney.com. He is a senior fellow there. I suppose I don't need to spend time telling you all about Alistair MacLeod. He's on so frequently, but I do like to remind you that he's been a stockbroker, and he has been deeply involved in the markets. Not just any stockbroker, I have to think. He never was my broker, but I have to think that Alistair was always diving deeper. Can't imagine that he was just trying to sell people stocks just for the sake of making money, because that's not – Alistair is a deep thinker, and that's why we like to have him on. He helps us to understand why things are happening, not just the fact that they are happening, but to understand the underpinnings, the dynamics underneath, and that's why he's so valuable to us. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
Yeah, it's really great, and I think we should tell people that I think it's every Thursday, more or less. It's Thursday, isn't it, when you put out your most recent piece, or is it Wednesday? Thursday.
It is Thursday, yes.
Yeah, Thursday.
So it's Thursday. Yeah. But actually, if I can just interject.
Yeah, sure.
I actually put one out tonight on the COMEX position in gold.
Oh, good.
Which I think your listeners might be interested in looking at. It's a very interesting juncture in the gold market at the moment. So from that point of view, I can recommend it, even though I wrote it.
Well, absolutely. So they should go to Gold Money, and it's the research page, and I think it's Gold Money Insights. Insights is what you write.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. And because we have so little time to cover what I want to cover, I won't ask you about that more, but we'll certainly be talking to you about it in the future, I'm sure. Today, I named today's show the Dollar Destruction and a Golden Chinese Currency. And you wrote three articles, Alistair. June 18th, the crisis goes up a gear. June 25, a collapsing dollar and China's monetary strategy. And then July 2nd, prices are going to rise and fast. Those three topics I'd like to get into. The crisis, first of all, maybe talk about the crisis goes up a gear, your June 18th article. In that article, you wrote, and I quote, dollar-denominated financial markets appear to have suffered a dramatic change on or about the 23rd of March, end of quote. So what changed on that day, Alistair, and what do you think the markets were telling us with those changes?
Well, it was just a fascinating juncture where suddenly everything had been in one trend, going in one direction, whatever that direction was. Some things were going up and some things were going down. And then suddenly they all reversed at that point. And gold, for example, bottomed on that day. In fact, actually, it was the day before that, the business day before. Copper, Dr. Copper, tells us all about Chinese demand for industrial materials and so on and so forth. That, after a period of falling, took off. The US dollar's trade-weighted index peaked at about 102, and since then it just tanked, really. Mm-hmm. The S&P 500, another one, that had been going down, and now it's been going up, and that was, again, the turning point. Silver-gold ratio, another interesting one. And last but not least, of course, oil, the WTI. But there is a caveat on oil because the following month there was that problem with the contract. If you remember, yeah. People were not expecting to take delivery when the contract came due in April, and consequently they had nowhere to put it, and they had to sell it, get rid of it at any price, including a negative price.
Incredible.
Yeah. So there were distortions in the markets, but the thing that's interesting is that there was this sort of inflection point where suddenly everything changed. Absolutely.
All right.
Everything.
So everything, basically, the dollar started to go down and everything else tangible started going up, and as well as the stock market, which has tangible and intangible elements to it.
Yes, that's correct. I would say the stock market is more it's financial assets. I mean, the reason they went up, I think, is that it became perfectly clear at that time that the Fed was just going to print money like billio to support asset prices. And, people got the hint. And I don't know, it could be that central banks are in there buying stocks as well. I mean, certainly the Swiss National Bank has been buying U.S. Mm-hmm. stocks. But it was just an interesting point.
Yeah, well, in spite of the fact that the central banks are suggesting, and not suggesting, they are pumping huge amounts of money into the system. I mean, we had the repo issue, which I think has still not been resolved by any means. But you state in your June 18th article, you said, and I quote again, "At this stage, an imminent banking crisis is now a near certainty, with most systematically important banks in a weaker position now than at the time of the Lehman crisis," end of quote. But Alistair, here in New York and in the U.S. here, we're assured that our banks are in great shape. They're well capitalized. What are you seeing that differs from that?
Well, I would agree to an extent that your banks are well capitalized, but only well capitalized in comparison with particularly the European banks. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the European banks are just absolutely incredible. The measure that I would use is not the balance sheet equity to total assets, mm-hmm. but the market value of that equity mm-hmm. in terms of the companies, the bank's capitalization relative to the balance sheet. Now, mm-hmm. if you take that, in other words, what we're saying is this is what the market reckons the equity capital on the balance sheet is worth. Uh-huh. In the case of Société Générale, at that time, the price to book, which is what we're talking about, mm-hmm. was 20%. I mean, mm-hmm. in other words, the price in the market was at an 80% discount to the book. Now, if you work that through in terms of relative to total assets, Societe Generale have a leverage as far as the market cap is concerned of 108.7 times.
Wow.
You know, Deutsche Bank, 74 times. Group Crédit Agricole, another French one, 73.8. Barclays in Britain, this should worry us, 63.8, and so on and so forth. Now, the best on that measure really are the American banks, because by and large, the share prices are trading at more or less book value. So you haven't got that huge difference. But if you look at the amount of debt that they have got to deal with, they have massive problems. Dollar debts are absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. And these banks have a problem, and that is they want to contract the amount of outstanding bank credit, mm-hmm. but the Fed needs them to increase the amount of outstanding yeah. bank credit to rescue all the businesses which are going sour. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wouldn't say at all that the American banks are in a good position. Yeah. It's only a relative story compared with banks elsewhere.
So the U.S. banks want to contract their balance sheet. They want to make fewer loans, no doubt, because they're looking at the economic landscape and they're not liking what they see for obvious reasons, I guess.
Yes. Just imagine if you're a director of a bank, you've not only got the COVID thing, but you've also seen how global trade is contracting, because your bank will be international in terms yeah. of its reach. You'll be seeing customers with supply chain payment problems. Just product isn't getting through. They're not getting paid, and they're still got to pay the rent. And you've got, shopping malls and all the rest of it who are not getting their rent. You're sitting there, think now, is this an economy you want to expand your lending into? I would say no. I would definitely say no. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a real conflict between the Fed and the banks. And Alistair, you've made these alarming predictions that I think you think you can't know for sure, but with all the information you can pull together, in your view, that the dollar could be in some really big trouble before the end of this year, globally, I guess, as the world's reserve currency. I would like to ask you then, do you see a banking crisis as a trigger that might start to cause the dollar to shake? It's already down, as you pointed out, from its high on March 23rd, from about 102, I think you said, on the trade index. But do you see a relationship then between the potential banking crisis, global banking crisis, and the dollar?
Yes, I do. It's slightly broader than as you suggest, because mm-hmm. I don't think it's just the American banks. I don't know where it'll start. It could start in Europe. I mean, that's where the betting should go. But I really do think that the banking crisis, when it happens, will be so all-embracing. It won't be like the 1930s. You know, you get one bunch of banks going bust, and then another bunch going bust, and then another one going bust. I mean, you had rolling bankruptcies in the banks between 1930 and 1933. This, I think, will be a global problem. It'll be like the Lehman crisis. Suddenly we'll wake up one morning and think, oh, my God. But it'll be worse than Lehman. Now, what it means is that all governments will have to rescue their banks, the whole lot. Now, this will involve effectively underwriting not just the banking system, but all their customers. So yeah. the inflationary implications are absolutely enormous. And I think the banking crisis, when it happens, is a wake-up call as to really what's going on. It, if you like, is on the path to the destruction of fiat currencies. It won't be a cause of it.
Uh-huh. Alistair, let me ask you, what comes after trillion? What's the number that comes after trillions?
Quadrillion, I think.
We have billions, we have trillions. I guess we can do hundreds of trillions or billions of trillions. I don't know. I can't get my head around what $1 trillion. What $1 billion is hard enough. So what you're saying is, if I understand, all currencies, all Western currencies at least, are going to be in deep doo-doo.
Yeah, that is unless the national leaders somewhere sort of get to the point where they can actually call a halt to it mm-hmm. and introduce sound money policies. It's going to require two things. It's going to require stabilizing the currency, which is probably best done by linking it to gold at some level. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is it means cutting government commitments, financial commitments, and letting the economy sort itself out. I mean, that broadly is what used to happen before Herbert Hoover started intervening in the wake of the Wall Street crash. Before then, the recessions, depressions, if you like, were really quite quick affairs. The problem is that governments, when they intervene in the economy, they stop the process of creative destruction, because right. You need to reallocate national resources from yesterday's businesses to tomorrow's businesses. And that can only be done by entrepreneurs. It cannot be done by government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. In commenting on this subject of the currency's decline, the currency declines, you said, and I quote, "Anything that does not migrate from fiat pricing disappears, including most, if not all, ETFs. Goodbye to hedge funds. Goodbye to yep. offshore financial centers. Goodbye to onshore financial centers. Goodbye to $100 trillion of fiat money." Can you speculate about what life will be like if this pans out as you're envisioning it? I mean, it seems like a very frightening scenario.
You're right to call it frightening, because an awful lot of people are going to get hurt, and it'll be the people who are poorest, it will be the elderly, it will be the people who have been relying on pensions, and the pensions will buy nothing. So this is very, very serious. But to answer your question, what needs to happen is that sound money gradually comes into circulation. And here we're talking about, I think, probably silver more than gold. Mm-hmm. Because silver, if you like, people have got a lot of silver. There are lots of silver coins around. And I think that they will become the currency. I mean, there was a time, I think, when your silver coins in America were pure silver. Those, mm-hmm. I think, will come back and have a value. People will recognize them mm-hmm. as money for the exchange of goods. And the number of silver coins that have been produced, in your case, silver eagles and so on and so forth. In our case, we've had the Royal Mint has produced huge quantities of silver coins, commemorative coins very mm-hmm. much. And I think they will probably come back into circulation. So I think that is, if you like, if you have silver coinage, gold as well, but mainly silver for the day-to-day, then I think that that is probably going to enhance the chances of your survival in these times, and also the survival of your families and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. you know you must take account of them as well.
Yeah,
you know, it's not just you know, I've bought a whole load of silver coins, I'm all right, Jack. No.
Yeah.
This is a community thing, really.
Absolutely. More than ever, it's going to have to be a community thing. And you have to wonder, will trading silver or using it as a medium of exchange be the black market, or will the government allow it to take place? That's another issue, of course, that we don't have time to talk about today. But, you know, it seems to me, Alistair, what you're suggesting is that prices in terms of fiat, well, the fiat money will become worthless, essentially.
Yes.
Because it's just endless, you know, infinite amount of printing will make it worthless. So that people who actually own silver or gold, their purchasing power will grow dramatically, probably. So there will be a redistribution of wealth back towards honest money, away from this dishonest, what I would say, counterfeit money that governments produce, right?
I think you put it very well, yes.
Oh. So that's obviously then people want to, if they have some savings, make sure they don't have it sitting around in fiat. And of course, even since this new century began, gold has outperformed Warren Buffett's portfolio. So gold has done extremely well. And silver has a lot of catching up to do. Alistair, with regard to China, your second article that I referred to, A Collapsing Dollar and China's Monetary Strategy, published on June 25th. And again, folks, you can read these articles. Go to goldmoney.com and read them. They're archived there. But recently on this show, you suggested that you thought the end of this year that the dollar, you still stick to your timing or the idea that this could unravel very quickly for the dollar, that by the
yes,
end of this year we could see the dollar ceasing yeah. as the world's reserve currency, essentially?
Well, not just ceasing as the world's reserve currency, but ceasing as a currency, full stop.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Very quickly. I mean, all you need to do is to educate yourself about what John Law did 300 years ago.
Yes.
You know, it's exactly the same situation, except it's global rather than just restricted to France.
Oh, boy. Much worse. And in that regard, we don't have any place to run to. The whole world is in the same position, or at least the Western world. But I'm sure, you know, China's looking at this. As you pointed out, China has accumulated huge amounts of gold. And you have done a lot of work on this. You've observed flows from the West to the East and so forth. And what do you think? What do you think they're thinking now? They're certainly aware that the West is in deep trouble.
Yes, I mean this is such a difficult question to answer without being really very long-winded about it.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to money, they're being defensive. They would like to have the renminbi, the yuan, if you like, used more commonly for international settlements. They are doing that through swap agreements with all sorts of central banks. But the fact of the matter is that they've been using the dollar as the means of bribing, if you like, if we put it that way, the politicians in sub-Saharan Africa, anywhere where they have a relationship or need commodities. And, you know, it's dollars that they lend to these people. It's not renminbi, if you like. So, if you like, they will lose all that power the moment the dollar goes. So it's not in their interest to undermine the dollar. So while we've got this Cold War going on with China, I think it's worth bearing that in mind. So their response to a collapse in the dollar, I think it's going to be reactive. There will come a point where they have to abandon the policy of buying off, you know, sort of tin pot dictators in Central Africa or wherever. They'll have to abandon that and then start think about protecting their own currency. And at that stage, they, I think, will introduce some sort of gold backing. If they mess around with digitizing it, a crypto version of it or whatever, and this is apparently being tested at the moment, I think that would detract from it, but we'll just have to see. They are in a position to move to back their currency with gold at a far higher price, incidentally. And I think the moment they do that, of course, it will be absolute curtains for any remaining fiat currencies that don't follow suit.
So what might trigger China's interest in doing that? At the moment, the dollar's worth something, and so they can still use that to buy tin pot dictators, as you call them, in Africa to gain their resources or whatever else they want to have from those countries. Would it be then this sort of cancer that kills the patient, this ongoing debt-based economy that we have that kills that basically brings down the dollar, that would cause them to change their strategy because the dollar wouldn't buy anything anymore?
Yes, I mean, it'll be us that bring down the dollar, the pound, the euro, the yen, and so on. So it will be us who do it. Mm-hmm. What China will not want to do is to be in a position where we turn around and say, it's not us, it's China that did it. Because that, you know, that would just... I mean, that would be crazy. It'd be wrong and crazy. So I think that there will come a time where they abandon the international monetary system and go their own way. But they will only do that when it's absolutely obvious that the international monetary system is in a state of collapse and will collapse without any doubt.
Yeah. But what you're saying is that could happen fairly quickly. I mean, it's not going to be 20 or 30 years from now.
No, I mean, all history says that you can have a long, long period of erosion of purchasing power for a fiat currency. But there comes a point where suddenly it's usually first the international users of it discard it. And they've got an awful lot of dollars to discard. So that's the first phase. The second phase is that the man in the street, Main Street, if you like, realizes the fraud that's been perpetuated through the printing of money. He realizes what's going on. He realizes that the purchasing power of the money is going to zero, and he gets rid of it as quickly as possible. And that stage in Germany in 1923 was basically between about May and November 1923, 6 months.
Yeah.
This could be about 6 months as well. And going back to that March the 23rd date, I just note that that was an inflection point. Yeah. And I think that's probably, we'll look back, the historians will look back and perhaps identify as that as the turning point in destruction of currencies.
Yeah, well, it's continued, as you said. And just with a couple of minutes left yet, I want to ask you, in your article, Prices Are Going to Rise and Fast, July 2nd, you talked about monetary transmission problems as part of the mechanism, I think, that causes things to unravel. Can you just comment on what you meant by that?
Yes. I mean, I think the problem we've got is one we referred to earlier in terms of the transmission of the Fed's money printing, if you like, into mm-hmm. Main Street. At the moment, it's quite obviously going into Wall Street and nowhere else. So we've got this ridiculous situation where Wall Street valuations just don't bear any relation at all to what's going on in the real world.
Yeah, right. So
it's that is the transmission problem. And it comes about because the banks, as we discussed earlier, do not want to extend bank credit to anyone. I mean, they want to contract their balance sheets. They want to get out of risk. They don't want to take on more risk. So whatever the Fed says, I'm sorry, but that's not the route that money is going to get into Main Street. And so, you know, it'll be helicoptered, whatever. There will be direct loans to corporates. And I guess the U.S. Treasury will probably end up buying out, or if you like, acquiring all the banks, acquiring major businesses, trying to support the whole caboodle. And of course, you can't support the whole of the private sector economy without destroying your currency.
And right.
I think there's one little myth which I try to destroy in that, and that is that the Keynesians think that if you get a contracting economy, then prices fall. No. If you get a contracting economy, it is both the supply side, of product and all the rest of it, and the demand side going down. But what happens in this case is that we can see you get stagflation, you get inflation, particularly of certain demanded items. I mean, right. Nobody will be buying luxury SUVs, or at least very few people will.
Yeah.
But everybody will be buying food. Everybody will be buying energy. And just watch the prices of those rise.
Of those items, yeah. You know, we're going to have to leave it go at that. I wanted to ask you about the economy. I think the V-shaped recovery is a myth. It's not going to happen. That feeds into the things you were talking about, the banks collapsing and so forth. Alistair, we have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much for sharing your insights. Always very valuable.
And That's my pleasure.
Hope to do it again sometime soon. Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Jeff Dice of the Mises Institute will be with me. Chris Taylor of Great Bear and Michael Oliver will be back next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Benchmark Metals is a gold-silver exploration company that is embarking on its largest program to date on the Lawyers Project, with up to 50,000 meters of resource expansion and definition drilling planned in 2020. The multi-million-ounce potential project is expected to have a new mineral resource estimate and PEA study completed in 2021. The company is backed by the Metals Group management team and believes this aggressive program will be complemented by one of the strongest commodity bull markets in decades. Visit benchmarkmetals.com and subscribe to follow their success.